WNTI.org. This is Greg Jones. Our show's The Grapevine. We're going to be here till 9 o'clock in the studio with our special guest, Gary Ault. We're going to be talking about his music, old music, playing some CDs, his new music live in the studio, and some of his new writing adventures as well. He's going to tell us about that and maybe read us a little bit of it. So stay right here. We'll be here till 9 o'clock and back in 60 seconds.
The Trevor B. Power Show on WNTI.org, the internet voice of Centenary University, on Thursdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Playing the Allman Brothers Band, the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, and all the players that influenced them. So if you want to hear some killer blues, soul, and rock and roll, the Trevor B. Power Show on WNTI.org, the sound of Centenary.
Hi, this is KDO, host of KDO Radio. Tune in Mondays from 6 to 7 p.m. for a mix of alternative, including indie, ska, and punk. So join me Mondays from 6 to 7 p.m. on WNCI.org, the internet voice of Centenary University.
Like money.
WNTI.org. That was a Cowboy Junkies with Miles from Our Home. I'm Greg Jones. We're shows The Grapevine. We're here till 9 o'clock tonight in the studio with Gary Ault. Gary Ault has a, I called you a polymath today on Facebook, which is a word. Look it up. Gary was used to have his own show here on WNTI as a radio host. He's written several books, and we're going to talk about that tonight. And he's got a whole stack of CDs here. He's been publishing music for quite a while, and some new ones, I guess, in the works. Gary, thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. Well, sort of. You know, it's like coming home, but it's, I don't know, it's dysfunctional, isn't it?
Coming back to the studio where you work for years.
Yeah. No, I'm kind of kidding around.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. When your show was on Wednesday at 8?
Yeah.
For how long were you on here?
Oh, man, from 2012 to whenever we went off the air. I guess it was 3-4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
4 years later, maybe. And then, you know, of course, we did the streaming thing. I stayed with that till, so I don't know, maybe like 5 years altogether. Not a long time. I can't say I'm like Cousin Brucey or something. But,
right.
But it was a heck of a run. It was a real blast.
Because it's funny, I run into other DJs. I think it's kind of like musicians. You're like, no, I don't know him. Why? Because we're in different places at different times by design.
Right.
So on Saturday nights, the musicians don't hear. But the DJs I run into, you know, how long have you been here? 17 years. How long have you been here? I'll be over 20.
Right.
So it's just kind of like Trevor for, I don't know, right. Close to 10.
Well, somebody,
I'm at like 2.5 now. So
well, somebody has to be the new guy. I mean, I was the new guy for a while, and I felt, you know, like the infant or whatever. And then I forget who came along, and now I can pick on him, I guess, you know.
And actually, there's been, if you look at our schedule, there's been a lot of kind of veterans coming in from other places and taking slots. And I'm thinking Mike Watterson, right? Is it Watterson?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the guy who came over from FM. FMJ. Anyway, there have been some people that came here for shows, for homes for their shows, maybe is the way to put it. But and what did your radio show focus on when you were on?
Well, it started out as a Beatles show because I was actually replacing Scott Acton, so it was a 1-hour Beatles show, and I thought it was a privilege to do it. But at some point, I think people got tired of the fact that they were under the impression that I wasn't playing much Beatles stuff. And it's just really because they didn't know what the heck I was playing. I'm playing stuff like Splinter. Well, who's that? Well, it's a George Harrison project, you know, right. or a group that he produced, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was always trying to do stuff like that where they cross-pollinated with someone or whatever. So Spider got the idea one day because he knew I was more of a Clapton fan than anything else of making it a Clapton show. So we changed it to Crossroads and it became Clapton. Mm-hmm. And then around the time that we lost the FM signal to UPenn, went internet only, I think things just sort of loosened up, and I just made it a 2-hour show. I said, hey, is it okay if I go 2 hours? And nobody seemed to object. I don't know. And I just said, it's still Crossroads, but it's not Clapton-centric. It's maybe, you know, Beatles and Clapton heavy, but it's just about wherever music intersects, you know, wherever somebody brings a sitar and plays it on a pop record or something like that, or jazz merges with rock, you know. So that's when I really was having fun. It was really, you know, unfortunately to a limited audience, but, you know, so it evolved. And
yeah, Albie stayed here in the studio with us, and that's kind of really what both of us do, right?
It's so much easier to play with all the colors instead of
two
colors.
Right.
You know, when somebody says to you, oh, you can only do Beatles stuff, it's just, you're kind of mangered in, and it's not
exactly
because there's only two kinds of music,
right? Good music, good
and bad. Yeah, and it's like, name me one Beatles song that nobody's heard. I mean, even you know my name, look up the number. I mean, who hasn't heard that?
But you know what? It's funny when you look at those first three albums. Like tonight, I played what did I play? Baby, It's You.
Okay.
Now, when do you hear Baby, It's You on the radio?
That's true. Yeah,
you know,
that's an oldie.
The obscure ones from the early albums you can still throw out there, and it sounds great. But it was Johnny's band back then. John Lennon's band with them as backing guys,
pretty much.
Until it evolved. But I could talk to you for Beatles for hours.
Go for a long time. I know a couple of guys that are actually Beatles experts that are like Darren DeVivo, my favorite DJ ever over at can I say WFUV? I just did.
Sure.
Cut that. Which cough button?
I mean, I really don't listen to the station anymore, but what a great DJ. And he, ask him anything about McCartney or the Beatles, and he's got it down.
When you hear Paul in interviews, he goes, I don't know, but there's people out there that do know everything I've done through my entire life.
Yeah, right. So, yep.
Well, you know, when I started, I thought, there's things that I'm not going to do just to be different.
Right.
It wasn't going to be the Dead, because I love the Dead, and I'm going to play the Dead.
Right.
But I've never played a Springsteen song in 2.5 years.
He's proud of that.
And I don't think I've ever played a Beatles song.
No. Oh, boo, boo,
but
boo,
what
boo.
I do, I have one song that I'm nuts about. Well, I know, I've played Junior's Farm and Instant Karma, which are really post-bit.
Right.
But those two, I just love those songs, so like every couple of weeks they'll be in there. But yeah, I remember one time I brought in a CD that had a mix of Springsteen. I put it down here and I just looked at it all night and I'm like, can't do it, man.
Yeah.
Hometown hero, come on.
I think. Well, when I used to do Spider Show or Mel Show during the week, and you had to do the
Dead and Zappa.
We had to do the Dead and the Zappa, which I love doing in Zappa, but because I love those guys, the what we call the blues and the oranges, you know, these index cards that you'd have to go through, and if Bruce Springsteen came up, it means you had to play a Bruce Springsteen song. Every single time I played the same song.
What song?
Something about a can't light a candle without a spark, can't light a fire without a spark.
Dancing in the dark.
Yeah, right. I love that song.
Once with Courtney Cox.
Yeah,
the video where she got up on stage.
The video was what turned me onto the song because it seemed so spontaneous, and I had no idea until years later that it was completely Courtney Cox. I mean, come on, it was choreographed, you know. But I love the song.
Turn you on to Courtney Cox.
But I love that song, and that's all I can say about Bruce Springsteen.
We can say about Spider Shift, because I used to do Spider Shift a lot too. It was a great shift to cover, because people be driving home. It was 3 to 6, something like that, or 4 to 6. So people are driving home from work, and we start out with the Dead, and we finish up with Zappa, and we could just, it was like an open book in between.
Right.
So nobody bothered us. We just played what we want, but you know, bookends, and you know, my knowledge, I love the Dead, but my knowledge of Zappa is very, and his knowledge of Zappa is huge.
Right.
So I'd play the same 7 Zappa songs I know, and, you know.
Right.
You'd probably do the same.
Well, yeah, and I did the opposite, actually, because I know Zappa quite well. Mm-hmm. Spider's got the entire Zappa collection, actually, is a story behind that, but it's literally true. When it comes to the Dead, I don't know any of this Dick's Pick stuff. I'll just play U.S. Blues 15 times, you know. I like them, but I don't, not enough to know enough. So it was, I was always doing research, like, okay, where can I find, you know, maybe did any of those guys ever do a version of Bombs Away or something, you know? And I always liked doing it, but the Zappa thing really, I really loved that, you know, because it's also part of ending the show exactly at 7 o'clock in time for NPR.
Right.
I got a big charge of that because Spider's a pro at that. He would talk and talk and talk, and then he would stop and play the song, and it would end right at 7 o'clock on the dot.
Yeah.
So I was kind of proud that I was able to do that. Not quite as well as him, but
nail those landings, right?
Yeah. Anyway,
do people just rappel down the walls if you didn't hit it on the hour?
Well, I went over a couple of times. I was sitting at Mama's Cafe Bocce listening to the radio, and I'm like, because it wasn't supposed to be that NPR would actually turn off our signal.
At one point, it just automatically did, at the top of the hour, kicked us off.
Right.
So you'd have to land.
Right.
It'd be close. You start plotting it down. But then at the end, we had some controls. But
yeah, well,
my favorite fill-in shift was Spider Shift.
Yeah. I just remember Gregory Peccary going over like a half a minute into the NPR news. I was oh, what happened there? I miscalculated. So anyway, I'm not Spider. What can I tell you? I'm good. Half good, maybe. Almost good, but I'm not Spider.
Yeah, and Spider's on the radio with his own gig. And in fact, I texted with him today. I wanted to see if he wanted to call in, but he's still out there. And
Spider,
you guys spoke very highly of you, Gary, I can tell you.
Oh, that's good.
Called you a true gentleman.
Spider said that?
Where's that effect? I'll look it up later.
Wow. Jeez.
Something flattering.
Spider Glenn with 2 N's radio. Look it up. I recommend it. It's really good. Was it 3 to 7, I think, weekdays?
Yes. I should say SpiderGlennRadio.com. And you can turn us off right now and listen to it.
Yeah.
it's like Saturday. 3 to 6.
Okay.
3 to 6.
Okay.
Patty, you listen to it too, right?
Yeah.
I'm driving home at 6, so I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's a similar conundrum to what we have now, streaming. It's I get in my car and I can push one button and have WNTI with Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm.
But there are there's seems to be a huge technological hop for some people, either they have the older cars. And I'm like, your car's really old now if you don't, ever Bluetooth at, that point. And then they just won't make that play. And I always say to them, look, in 1970, we got four TV channels over an antenna on the roof. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the technology you're wedding to yourself to if you're over the air, and it's going to be internet. Because satellite isn't the economical way to put out a voice to the U.S. anymore. So it's, you got to jump on the bandwagon and know where that's where the game's going to be 15 years from now, or three, or, whatever the... So let's see. I have queued up here a song called Dance from your Art of Survival CD.
Right.
So why don't we jump to that? This is Greg Jones of the Grapevine. We're here in the studio with Gary Ault. He's going to feed us some songs pretty soon and talk about his new book, Force of Will. And we're going to keep Albie around for a little bit. Back, let's see. This is Dance off Art of Survivor by Gary.
I want you to do just one thing. If I'm gonna be with you, you gotta rev my motor before I switch into drive. Dance, dance, dance. I want you to dance. 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 Dance, dance, dance. I want you to dance.
WNTI.org. We were back. That was a dance by Gary Ault, who's here in the studio. That was off his CD, Art of Survival. So, first off, you gave me a couple of CDs here, Gary. Where can our listeners find them and buy them?
Well, anywhere you'd find music. I mean, Amazon, or you can stream them on Spotify. Any website you can think of, probably. But I prefer, because the way Amazon takes your money, basically, the actual distributor is cdbaby.com. So if you go to cdbaby.com and just search for my name, for Art of Survival, whatever you want to look for, I make about, I don't know, 10 times as much money. Not that I'm getting rich. It's not like, you know,
right,
if you pay 15 for a CD, I'm not making $20, obviously. But yeah, it's just so much better for the musician. Same with the book. You know, you go to bookbaby.com, you know, you can buy it at Amazon or Barnes and Noble, but I'm getting a buck.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's amazing, because I supplied the commodity that they're selling. I spent 3-4 months writing this book. I spent months recording the CD, writing the song, you know, and I give it to these people, and they wouldn't be able to sell it if I didn't give it to them, and they give me a dollar back. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, what, like, a world.
Content is free. That's
Yeah. So anyway, that's my gripe for the evening. I'm done. I'm all happy. Right.
So you got your guitar out here, and we got some video rolling. What are you going to start out with there?
Well, I figured I'd play my latest composition. Well, I don't know if it's my latest, but it's recent anyway. And I'm putting my glasses on so I can see the words. Called Western Lady. I haven't recorded this yet. I mean, I've done really rough demos just to kind of shop it around a little bit. But and I got this for basically sitting in a Longhorn Steakhouse having dinner one night. You know, they always have that country music in the background. You can barely hear it, but it's enough to know something's going on. And I hear things wrong a lot, and it gives me ideas for a song. And I was kind of grooving on something. I'm not really a country music fan per se, but I was kind of grooving on it and thinking that was pretty cool. And what if we did it like this? I thought, you know, I'm not saying I could do it better, but I'm different because mm-hmm. I'm not a country guy. So it's sort of a country song, but not. I don't know. You could tell me. Called Western Lady. Ready? I got to be in tune. Looking to fall for a Western lady. She can move, yeah, she can play me. Lighting with the daydream, better not beware. Looking to fall for a Western lady. Sun don't set on my Western lady. Where she lies, she brings the day. Fly away to greet me, shadows in the air. Sun don't set on my Western lady. Now, 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 she burns like eternal fire. Now, 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 she's got me on a wire. With desire. Oh, the sting of my Western lady feels so right when my heart betrays me. Dance across the ocean with the wind. Feel the sting of my Western lady. Now, 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 she burns like eternal fire. Got me on a wire. Now, 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 I'm burning like eternal fire. Lose me. She can break, but I won't break free. Fly away to Thank you.
What's the proper name of that song? Western Lady?
Western Lady, yeah. Yeah, it could be Southern Lady. I mean, I actually wrote it and gave it to somebody who knows if he'll record it, but I said, you can make it Southern Lady. Well, I don't know, Eastern Lady? American Lady or American Woman?
Western Lady works. I think that works.
Yeah, so, you know.
So during the breaks here, we were having some great conversations with these two musical minds in the studio. I'll just take some of that off-camera stuff, put it back on here. Albie, if you were going to be stuck on a desert island, what's the one that CD you would bring?
I would vote for John Barleycorn Must Die. I never get sick of that CD.
Yeah.
I think it's a great album.
Yeah.
You know, Traffic was just an amazing... Traffic was like one of the best jazz infused rock band.
Yeah,
you think
yeah.
about it, because yeah. these guys were like jazz players,
yeah.
and they would riff off with these beautiful things. And but John Barleycorn Must Die, dynamite.
And great, so, you know, Steve Winwood was a great songwriter.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
Yeah, we saw him last year. I don't know what March, Patty.
March, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like just for
the Sands.
Right. And what I liked about him is it was. A nostalgia act, I suppose, but he, you know, it wasn't masked. He didn't come out. He went like 1, 2, 3, and he played like the 15 songs you wanted to hear. Right. And then he's like, "Thank you, good night."
And
it's like,
and he had another gig that night.
Did he really?
Right?
Yeah,
he was flying somewhere.
He was helicoptering off to play with Phil Lesh and friends up in Westchester County or something like that.
You know, for a guy who's 72, I believe. You know, because he started at 15 in the Spencer Davis.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, he looks like a child in those photos.
But he sounded like a 40-year-old man.
And now his voice still sounds great.
Yeah.
It literally, we have video of it somewhere, and his voice just sounded like right off the CD in 1971 mm-hmm. or whatever. Yeah, it was great. So what I always say is, even if you hate Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon is one of the top five.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody that hates Tom Waits, but Nighthawks at the Diner has got to be in the mix.
Yeah.
So you can hate them, but they're, you know.
Right.
They're up there, one of the best CDs. Let's see. Why don't we transition a little bit? Tell us about your new book, Force of Will, which is actually kind of like dropping, or you're having its first premiere, right?
It was published, I guess, about a year ago, and I've done, you know, some book readings and things like that, but we're doing a book festival in Easton, PA this coming, the festival is all Friday through Sunday, but I'm going to be at the First Presbyterian Church on Saturday all day, like from, I don't know, 9 to 4 or 8 to 4, or I think it's 9 to 4, mm-hmm. maybe 10 to 4, I don't know. Don't come at 9 o'clock, put it that way. and then I'm going to be actually doing a reading. I'll tell you where that is in a second here. Not at the same venue. It is QED. No. Quadrant Bookmart and Coffee House, which looks like a really cool place. I haven't been there, but they got a great menu. I mean, really cool menu. And it's more of a bookstore than it is an eatery, you know. And I'm going to be reading, excerpts from the book for about a half hour from 2 to 3:30. And then I'll be back at the First Presbyterian Church. So it's all in Easton. It's all available on the net. You can go to eastonbookfestival.com and find out all about it.
Now, this is your third book?
This is actually my first, and I finished my second recently.
Okay.
But I'll tell you just real quickly about the second book. It's sort of a sequel to the first one. So I have to explain. The first one is based on a true story, in that I've changed the names of people and places, and, you know, conversations and characters are compressed and things like that. Not too much that's absolutely made up, but the things that are just plain old made up are just to propel the story forward, but have nothing to do with the veracity of the story. So it's really a true story, you know, top to bottom. But there are things missing. You know, there are questions that people have, like why did this guy put up with so much nonsense for 30 freaking years, you know, and stuff like that. And I only really figured out the answer to that fairly recently, just through some, you know, self-examination. And so I figured I'd write about that and the other discoveries that have been made in terms of, there's a big religious component in the book. It's not about a religion or anything like that, but there's a big religious component. And, you know, all kinds of discovery about, you know, where did this idea come from, and why do people behave the way they do if they're saying they're Christian or whatever they're claiming, you know. So I wrote a sequel, and it's actually affectionately known in certain circles as the 90 pages, because it's only 90 pages, or at least in the PDF format I've got it in now. And but it's
like a novella.
Yeah, yeah, but it's really written more like a biography, really. You know, so it's not a story in itself. It just kind of explains things. You know, so anyway, the first one, the one I'm talking about, and I'm going to be mainly dealing with at the book festival, Force of Will, is the based on a true story novel form based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, how'd you go about publishing it?
There are actually a number. I mean, once you buy something, or once you look at something, you know, if you look at a cloud, the next in the sky, the next thing you know, you're going to get ads for clouds. I mean, it's an amazing world.
They know.
We're in.
There are any
number of self-publishing outlets, you know, and I chose one called Book Baby because they're associated with CD Baby. It's the same parent company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you hand them a manuscript and they'll edit it for you if you want, and they'll help you with artwork and stuff like that. They paginate it and, you know, compose it, I guess I should say. And then it's print on demand, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really only in the hundreds, the ones I've placed so far. But, you know, if 10 people order it tomorrow, they'll print 10 books and ship them out. You know, and then so you can get it through Amazon. But again, please go to Book Baby because I make about 9 or 10 times as much money. I get the dollar from Amazon. Big deal. You know, so I'll never recover my costs from Amazon, believe me. So
give us a kind of a piece of the plot here. Like, where's it located?
Okay,
geographically.
Some of it takes place here at the radio station, but because in the interest of changing the story around, I I'll have to explain how I'm on the radio explaining something that I deliberately tried to obfuscate. I'll get to that in a minute, but I changed it to, I don't know, I forget, Krenley College in Randolph, which doesn't exist, you know. I just didn't want anybody snooping around. I had the protagonist living in Sparta, where it really was about 20 miles from there. So, you know, everything's 20 miles from here and, you know, slightly different name and this and that. But it's a New Jersey story. Ends up in Pennsylvania in the Poconos. So the reason, I don't know, maybe I should explain what I was just talking about in terms of the, coming right out with things. It's written by Tan Swiftwater. But the fact is that, and I mean, this is the first time I'm saying this in an actual public setting, is that I actually wrote the book. So there is a religious component. It's not about religion. It's not a lot of doctrinal stuff and this and that, but it's inescapable that the only way the horrific things that happened in the book to the protagonist could never have happened if not for a strong fanatical streak puritanical, fundamentalist kind of interpretation of things.
Yeah.
A lot of thought control and stuff like that. The only way the book, the story could ever have even happened is because of this religious component. So it's not about the religion, and it doesn't, you know, necessarily bash it or recommend it. It's just part of the story. It's like a composite character.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people are, of course, of that religion. So it so happens that I use the pseudonym because if somebody decides that they feel that they recognize their themselves in the book and they don't like the way they're represented, then I could be in trouble. But whether they're correct or not doesn't matter. I just don't want to have problems, you know. So, but I'm here on the radio telling you that, which might sound pretty counterintuitive, because they are such an insular group of people. They're so removed from society that I seriously doubt that one of them is listening to this broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't listen to normal radio. They just don't do things like that because they're just so busy with their crazy lives, you know. Well, I shouldn't say crazy, but that's, you know, with their activities, you know. So I'm not worried about it. So I'm not secretive about it, but I'm not going out and I'm not going to go on TV, for instance. I have a friend in Pennsylvania that has a TV station, and we talked about me going on, and I'm like, well, how am I going to do that? You can see my face and everything. I just figured people at WNTI know who I am. I can't hide it, you know.
So,
and I'm promoting.
Are you religious yourself, or
no,
are you unchanged?
No, I'm a very spiritual person. I've always considered myself a very spiritual person, but I was involved in the religion for decades, and not because I never considered myself religious. I consider myself spiritual and very, you know, full of faith kind of a person. But I never really was impressed with all the trappings of organized religion. It's almost like a necessary evil, I guess you might say. I get it, you know, but so I'm not complaining about it. But as I said, the more mind controlling, you know, fundamentalist kind of aspects of this particular group made these horrendous behaviors on behalf of people that consider themselves good people. And I think actually they are, for the most part, very good people. A lot of old friends that are no longer friends, unfortunately. But it wouldn't have been possible if not for this very bizarre interpretation of things.
Certainly I think everybody on earth would be better if you followed the Ten Commandments. But I went to Catholic school and got, I served 4 years of a 12-year sentence and got out for bad behavior. And the trappings are the bad part. The if you wanted to follow the you know, words of Jesus and the Ten Commandments from the Older Testament, but it can get people tied in knots.
What ends up happening is people rationalize things, and they can you can talk somebody into believing anything. Once you've got their mind in your pocket, you can get them to believe anything, and you can twist something around. For example, the protagonist in the book, one of the things that happened is immediately that the night that his wife decided that she didn't want him anymore, this story went like wildfire all over the country, all the way out to the West Coast, all the way to Guatemala, I mean, everywhere. And everybody believed it with absolutely no foundation, no basis in fact, nothing, no evidence or anything like that. And So what ended up happening was he was basically shunned by all these people because he supposedly did this thing long before there was any kind of investigation into it, like 4 years before anybody did anything to deal with the situation. The character's name is Gil Oldfield in the book, which is me, was completely shunned by these people. Well, how do you justify that? I mean, that's really cruel. I mean, even the kids and the family, you know, just like, no, the guy doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really bizarre interpretation of what love means, you know, because if you love this person, you'll obey the authorities in the organization that say you should not talk to him anymore. It's just for his own good because he has to come around and repent and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Unfortunately, in America, you know, what you describe is like every single divorce ever.
Right.
Because that's the way the system works.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get control of the custody of the kids and you demonize the other ones, well, they're paying you a monthly check instead of you know.
Right.
So there's a whole family court law that I dealt with, not personally, but in my circle, that is truly evil. I don't know if it's as evil as the religious component that your character ran into, but you know, there's lawyers there. Just this is how they make money, whipping people up in anger against each other.
Yeah. And it's sad that people buy, and I've seen that in a lot of divorces. It has nothing to do with religion necessarily.
And you split and you get the friends and who gets the...
Right, you know, right, exactly. It's like everybody decides they need to take sides. I don't know why, but they decide, they have to decide is you know, Louise or Fred or whatever at fault or who's... And it's like, if Louise is the good person, then it's all about her and this guy's hard. I don't know why, and even my own kids, why they felt the need to do that. They just couldn't figure out a way of loving both parents, you know. It's beyond me. I don't know how those things even happen. But like I said, without that religious component, it would never have happened because they're the authorities in this religion basically tell people what to think, and they don't have to support it with any facts. They just tell you that, yeah, we talked to this guy, and, you know, he's not somebody you really want to be associating with. Oh, okay, all right, fine, thank you. You know, and they think that's the best thing to do, and it's based on nothing, absolutely nothing.
Well, and unfortunately, in that religious component, and it's more if you go back and study the history of religion in Europe, you know, they're a business, so they're going to look at the two people and go, we want that parent and those two kids going to our school,
right,
or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, they're very much a bottom line oriented structure. Almost anyone that you went to, and then you look at the thin line between cult and religion, and my brother-in-law, former brother-in-law, wrote a book that Cults That Kill.
Yeah.
And it was after the Reverend Jim Jones thing.
Right.
And I helped him a little bit, but he was all over the news because cults, you know, but then where's the line?
Right.
You know, and it's blurred more and more between organized religions. And,
Well,
I'm thinking of starting a cult, frankly, because the tax benefit. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. No, it is really true. And I'll tell you, I struggled for a long time with you know, thinking that this group is a cult. I was, because that's what a lot of people will say. And I'd say that's like calling a woman a whore. You know, it's a really awful thing to say. Like, because you're not just saying what she does for a living or whatever. You're impugning her character. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're doing when you call a group a cult. And if you don't know what you're talking about, you should kind of be careful. So it wasn't until earlier this year, actually, that I actually did sufficient research. I kind of, you know, was gotten over all the exhaustion of the whole experience and getting my life back together. And I actually did some research, and I won't tell you the conclusion that I drew, but it doesn't, put it this way, it doesn't bother me if people want to call Jehovah's Witnesses a cult, because there's cult-like stuff going on, I'll put it that way. A lot of mind control.
And Scientology is, you know.
Yeah, well, they're famous.
They're the pick of the litter.
Exactly. They're more famous for it because, people disappear and stuff, you know, but... The witnesses are not overtly like, oh, it's obvious they're a cult, because there's a lot of love going on, and they don't, you know, people think that they're thinking for themselves. Like, it's not obvious. It's really, you know, and I had to think back to, for example, one of the things that identifies a cult is the way they recruit. You know, at some point, really close to the beginning, you're told what to think and what to believe, and you're suckered in, and they use all kinds of deception, like visual confusion and sleep deprivation and things like that. And none of those things happened to me. I don't know anybody that ever happened to in the witnesses. But there is a point where a person decides in their own mind that, wow, this is the truth. This is the truth. There is a truth, and this is the only religion that is the true religion. And once you've made let your mind go down that path, you're in their palm.
And
they can tell you anything.
There's also just a basic social psychological impact of that. They become your support group, and since they've got a bottom line game in it, it benefits them to cut you off from your other support groups and people. So you're demonizing your family. You're demonizing anybody they feel is a threat to the financial chain. Now, maybe it's not all financial. Maybe it's just, you know, people with their own needs to build it up. But that's that's a fascinating conversation, and one that America should have.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to be back in 60 seconds with Gary Ault discussing more of his book, Force of Will, and playing some of his tunes, new and old. Keep it right here.
This is Rick from Randolph, host of the Local Artist Spotlight, heard every Saturday night from 9 p.m. to 11 on WNTI.org. I play songs by local artists, take listener requests, interview local artists who might perform their own songs and favorite covers, and sometimes I drift from my charter and play stuff just because it's stuff that I like to hear. We hope that you'll listen to the Local Artist Spotlight every Saturday night from 9 p.m. to 11. I'm Rick from Randolph, and this is WNTI.org, the sound of Centenary.
Hey there, this is Mike Stokes inviting you to join me for 3 great hours of blues music every Wednesday. You'll hear everything from blues classics through the latest releases. If you like your blues hot, tune in to Royal Blues every Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. here on WNTI, the sound of Centenary University. And in our blues club, requests are always welcome.
WNTI.org. I'm Greg Jones, and our show's The Grapevine. We're going to be here for the next hour with Gary Ault, who is a polymath. I always want to say polygamist. I can't say that. That's not going to work. Who's a writer, a former host here on WNTI, and a fabulous musician. I have a stack of CDs here from him. Back into the past, and he's got his guitar in his hand. But first, we asked you a very interesting discussion about your new book, Force of Will. And we were going to talk about you reading a little bit of it and get a taste for it.
Okay. Well, I'll just explain, because there's an awful lot that happens in this little thing, that this is after – it starts pretty quickly. Everything hits the fan, you know. And this is a moment where it was like the enormity of what just happened in just 3 days all of a sudden hit Gil, which is me, of course. And he's at his parents' house in Bryn Mawr, which is actually in Delaware. But All right, so and then I want to read one other segment just as long that shows you what a happy ending can be. Okay, so Gil shut down his laptop and sat on the living room couch while Goost and Nancy sat at the small table in the breakfast nook adjacent to the living room. The increasing enormity of the situation flooded Gil's heart and mind. In less than 2 days, he learned that his wife may have been seriously hurt, but he was not permitted to know how or where she was. He was falsely accused of committing the alleged violent crime that supposedly hurt her. His beloved son was brought into the equation cruelly by his wife, completely falling hook, line, and sinker for every accusation and mischaracterization leveled by his wife against him. He was arrested, questioned relentlessly, physically abused and degraded, deprived of sleep, told where he could not live, what car he must drive. Friends all over the country were cutting him out of their lives. Friends in his own congregation were refusing his calls and ignoring him when he desperately needed their help. He was slandered by his wife to an erstwhile dear friend 150 miles away, who evidently began the slander chain in earnest, accused of attempted murder, with that piece of slander reaching as far as New Mexico, accused by one of his dearest friends of all sorts of social crimes for which no substantiation was offered, and that evidence was now being used to support the absurd notion that the original accusation that started with this whole chain of events was true. And if all of that was not enough, the bottom line was that his marriage was probably over. His wife of some 30 years had finally dumped him in the most cruel way imaginable, and in the process managed to turn his own offspring against him, as well as many of his friends, and terrified his parents to the point where he nearly lost his father to a heart attack at the age of 79. All in 2 days. As if a dormant volcano, simmering and waiting to erupt, finally did so, Gil began weeping profusely, uncontrollably, and convulsively. There was the evidence, the raw emotion that the state troopers would never see, the evidence that Kirk needed to hear in order to even begin to believe that his father was innocent. There were the tears and raw, intense emotion that Gil could not and would not produce on cue for judgmental hypocrites. There were the tears that could have proven that Gil was truly concerned about his wife's welfare after he heard the news of whatever happened to her. There was the circumstantial evidence he needed to top off the mountain of physical and other evidence that he had only begun to be collected, but would soon grow beyond the peak of Mount Everest. There, in the safety of Mom and Dad's home, were the tears. Nancy immediately rushed into the living room to hold and console her broken son. Meanwhile, Goost remained at the table, about 15 or 20 feet away from Gil and Nancy, staring straight ahead into the kitchen at nothing. About a half century ago, he would have registered his disappointment with his son's unmanly tears with a stern talking to at the very least. On this occasion, however, he showed no reaction at all. It was as if he understood. He understood that his son had just experienced something no one ever should, something no human is meant to be able to cope with, something impossible to not utterly fall to pieces over. Gil's personal Superman would and could neither show that he disapproved or nor acknowledged those tears. Goost understood that, and Gil understood why. A tree had fallen, and the raging fire that had just started would grow far, far wider in a very short period of time. So now I want to just go to the end, because all these things happen, you know. And this has to do with a character who is called Carla, I believe. I think that's her name. Who figures into the book.
Go ahead. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
It's beautifully written.
Oh, thanks.
Both the you know, raw emotions and then the descriptive places that you put over it for the character's emotion too. It's really really beautifully written. I think what is it said? Every American has a novel in their bottom drawer, and that's where it should stay. Right?
Yeah.
And I have one too. When you hear great writing sometimes, you're like, all right, I'm going to keep it in that drawer.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people writing books nowadays that you know, they want to tell their story. It's really, and I guess it's partly because of the ease, basically, not of writing, but of getting it published. You know, you go to a print-on-demand outfit, and there you have it. You know, they put it on Amazon for you and all that stuff, so yeah.
Yeah, and Amazon actually has, a function like that where they do the print-on-demand.
Yeah.
But I've been a professional writer all my career, doing things like corporate annual reports.
Mm-hmm.
So when I decided to try to start a novel, most people are like, I read about it and they're like, I got to do my 2,500 words today. I sit there, hum. And what happened is I look down and like I had 130,000 words and hadn't come to the ending.
So I was like,
this is a trilogy? I don't know. But again, you're blending there of the narrative and the emotion. It's just really beautiful.
Right. Yeah, very thank you.
So you're going to read another excerpt that takes the characters forward in the...
And the reason I'm reading this, it's the last chapter, and yet it doesn't give away the ending.
Okay.
Because the ending, it's a multi-surprise ending, actually. But this is, I mean, basically what happened over the course of, you know, this thing that just happened was two nights after my radio show, actually. That was when I found out about that, you know, that my son called me at the radio station and said, why'd you hit mom? You know, and I said, what? Like, excuse me? Mm. And it turns out that she accused me of hitting her while I was here. You know, she's home 30 miles north of here, and I was here, and everybody knew that, but except the witnesses, because they don't listen to the radio, so they believed her. Mm-hmm. And you know, I went home and got her, and I was called to the police station. I'm going to pick up my wife, because she did that once in a while. She'd be at the hospital when they'd send her home with an aspirin or something. It's the way she is, you know. She exaggerates things and gets a little crazy. So I thought, I'm going to pick her up. And I said, yeah, I'll be there in 10 minutes, you know, and then I get arrested. So and then it's all this crap happened over the course of 2 days. So the next, 4 years or whatever was a matter of just getting my life back. I mean, I lost my job. I lost my bank accounts because she just took everything and closed the accounts on it when I wasn't looking. I had no place to live for a period of time, so I wasn't exactly checking my bank records every day. And, you know, lost my job because once you're arrested, you have to tell the FINRA, and that's, you know, I was a licensed financial advisor, and so they were like, okay, goodbye. So, you know, now what do you do? You have no money, no bank account, no ability to get money and things like this. So it was just a matter of, like, taking each day at a time, you know. And 4 years later, I at one point, I finally thought, I think my life's back together. I remarried, actually, and I, you know, had a good job back in the career that I had been in. So this is basically me visiting Carla, who was my good friend, not my wife. But so I will read it. It's a short chapter, but I'll read the whole thing. Spring is a time of renewal wrapped in intoxicating beauty. And of the 4 months that share that season, May wins top honors for its restorative powers. It's a time when the flora that began rejuvenating in the tentative and often deceitful days of late March announced that life has come back in earnest, their fresh light green hues politely refusing to yield to the darker shades that will paint a more summery portrait in just another month, a time when the sun has not yet learned to visit its stifling wrath on the world, but rather kisses the air with gentle, welcoming warmth. An endless variety of birds announce each new day and ensure that the rest of that day will be soaked in a symphony of sound and color. Every living thing, in concert with the sun, the clouds, and the air, seem to be saying, winter is over. It is safe to breathe the fresh, clean, warm air and embrace life again. On this second Sunday morning of May, Gil Oldfield sat at a table on the small patio of Carla Siciliano's cottage in Henryville, sipping a cup of tea with almond milk, taking in the sounds, sights, and smells of the day while listening to the Derek Trucks Band sail through a mesmerizing interpretation of Mongo's Santa Maria's Afro Blue, a la John Coltrane, and petting one of her five toy dogs, the Affin Pinscher named Jet, that had sent him to Pocono Urgent Care for a few stitches and some antibiotics just days ago. Jet had been taken in by Carla from a dysfunctional home, where he learned to bite anyone who dared to stand up in order to send the message that he would rather they not leave. With Gil again visiting at Carla's storybook house, safely seated in a folding lawn chair, it was time to remind Jet that it is possible, indeed preferable, to remain friends, and Gil was keen to share the peace pipe with him. Silly boy, you like having your belly rubbed, don't you? Yes, you do, don't you? There was an ever-so-small business matter to attend to. Ever since Gil moved in with his new wife, Julia, hence out of the apartment in Henryville, he continued to occasionally receive forwarded mail meant for Glenn Oldacre, their mutual friend who at one time lived at Carla's address. It seemed important that he hand-deliver an envelope from the Veterans Administration addressed to Glenn that he had received the day before, and that was his main purpose in visiting his good friend Carla. 10 minutes into his visit, Gil asked, "How is Glenn doing?" "Fine, from what I hear. He's not working for the auto repair guy anymore, but he's still living in his house for now. He's thinking of moving again to Florida, probably to Florida, but we'll see." Just then, the haunting strains of Stevie Ray Vaughan's Riviera Paradise made for a transition in the conversation. It was a favorite of Glenn, and also of Gil and Carla. Gil gestured into the air as if pointing at the sounds coming from the radio and said, "Speaking of Glenn, man, this song never gets old, does it? Beautiful, just beautiful." Carla agreed, "Yes, beautiful." Then, overcome by a peaceful smile, she topped off his cup and said, "I think it's time for another road trip." Gil simply smiled at Carla lovingly, fully recognizing what she meant. He took one more long sip of tea, thanked her for it and her company, got in his car and drove home to his new life partner, Julia, thinking with great pleasure and contentedness about what Carla's last words did and did not mean. Those words did not mean that a road trip with just the two of them was at all likely or even desired. In fact, those words had nothing to do with a road trip of any kind. Those words meant, "I understand you, I accept you, I believe in you, and I trust you."
Wow. That's great. That was Gary Ault reading an excerpt from Force of Will. And so that wasn't the penultimate chapter, that was the...
No, that's
that, the last one.
No, that's the last chapter. But the last six chapters are. That's the actual end of the story. I mean, it's I don't know how to explain it without giving it away, except to say that it's like there's multiple endings. I'll put it that way.
All right.
You know, trying to figure out what really happened. It's like up to you to figure it out, kind of thing. So it's sort of a mystery because, I mean, she made up this story, and there was nobody home, apparently, unless my daughter was there. I'll never know. Mm. So really, nobody knows what really happened except her. Right. And she's so, you know, prone to these bizarre thinking patterns and going to the hospital regularly for nothing. You don't know what's delusion and what's not. And, you know, without trying to criticize an individual, I don't think anybody will really know what the ending is, you know. So I came up with several endings, and you pick, you know. So
several possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so, yeah.
And you know, it does ring true from people in my life where maybe the driver, as we said before, isn't a religious aspect, but is simply family law in America, where you go to a lawyer and you want to get divorced, and they'll tell more often the wife, but I'm not going to be sexist about it.
Yeah.
And they'll say, go home and get a hell of a bump on your head and call the cops and say you're scared. Yeah. Your problems will be over in 3 hours. And, you know, that happens from, but of course there's other drivers other than that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But,
in this case, it was, you know, again, the religious, because the witnesses don't put any stock in, I shouldn't say anti-government, but they don't look at government and
civic want to use the legal system.
So in fact, to sue for a witness to sue another witness is like a big no-no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless it's like, you know, an insurance matter because one guy hit the other in traffic, you know.
Yeah.
No, you just don't do that. It should all matters should be solved by the elders in the congregation.
Right. Right.
And that's the way they look at it, and it creates some really major snafus because they don't know anything about the legal world. You know, they're just a bunch of laymen working wherever,
mm-hmm.
work selling shoes or fixing cars or whatever, and they don't know how to solve these problems. Mm-hmm. You know, so it creates for some fantastic collapses. You know,
it sounds like a fascinating story. That was we're talking about Force of Will by named Tan Swiftwater,
right.
Being described here in the studio by Gary Ault. Now, we're going to take a break here and come back. Actually, I think I'll jump in and play something off your Not For Sale to Minors CD. And then we're going to get some more songs live out of Gary here in the studio. WNTI.org, Grapevine, keep it right here.
The Trevor B. Power Show on WNTI.org.